Hello, everyone. If you remember, I had Richard Grove on episode 378 talking about Woodrow Wilson, and he mentioned that his autonomy course, where you're going to learn all the stuff that you didn't learn in school, is getting ready to start up again. If you want to link to it, it's at libertarianinstitute.org/Mance/378, and you'll see it right there. Thank you. Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Pete Quinones. I invited Jeff Dice to return to the show. Jeff is the president of the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. I wanted to have Jeff on to talk about negatives and positives in the age of the coronavirus. We're going to go over some of the worst things that we're seeing and some things that are really destroying people's lives. And then we're going to take a look at a couple things that could actually be positive outcomes in the future. So without any further delay, here is Jeff Dice. Jeff, thanks for talking to me today. How are you doing?
I am doing very well, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing well. Doing well, surprisingly. Wish that I was traveling somewhere, but yeah, that's not happening. So I wanted to have you on today to look at some of the consequences of this shutdown of the economy, the culture. People don't want to really talk about that, you know, people gathering, and just go over some of the negatives that are causing real damage to real people, and then possibly some good things that can come out of this if libertarians would get their way and can have some influence. But I mean, what have you, just overall, do you have a statement you want to make about what you're seeing and how this is handled?
It's interesting, isn't it? There's that famous line in The Big Short where I believe it is the Michael Scott character guy, whatever his name is in that movie, says, you know, for every 1% increase in unemployment, 40,000 people die. Did you know that? So obviously that's a dramatic line in a movie, and that's been fact-checked a little bit. But it, I believe, comes from the work of Greg Mankiw, who some of your listeners might know. He's a very mainstream economist up in Washington. He was, I believe he was on the Council of Economic Advisors for a couple different terms. I know he used to be an economist for the Joint Economic Committee. And these are very mainstream, vanilla, basically cheerleading organizations that are designed to pump whoever is currently president, to pump their economic programs. But Mankiw wrote a textbook. So I guess that makes him the new Paul Samuelson. And that textbook contains some data about what unemployment means, and it clearly does cause a lot of deaths. So this shutdown, from my perspective, is absolutely crazy. It's clearly illegal. I mean, let's just start with that. Judge Napolitano points out that, look, the Constitution requires due process before you shut down people's liberty, including their businesses and their movements. I mean, this is, you know, so the Constitution is so far gone. I apologize for bringing it up. But nonetheless, I mean, you're supposed to have to show a harm in a specific way in a court of law, and we're not doing that. So clearly at the federal level, this is just wildly illegal. So that's sort of an initial question. The second question is, illegal or not, is it wise? And it may in fact be legal at the state and local level. It depends on the various constitutions involved, various authorizing statutes for municipalities, et cetera, what city councils can do, what mayors can do. But nobody cares about that stuff. They're just doing whatever the hell they want. I noticed LA is going to shut off water and power to non-essential businesses. My God. So, I think it's a huge overreaction. It stems from, I think, a public mentality where trade-offs are no longer considered. People have become so dumbed down and so used to things like stimulus and the Fed and TARP and bailouts that they don't really get that there's any sort of trade-offs to these huge lever federal actions. That this is just is all good. That it's all upside, you know, which is really interesting if we think about it. And I wish I could observe this a little bit more systematically from afar, almost with a, you know, an impartial perspective as a psychological experiment about what's going on in America. But of course, I can't view it impartially because it's going to affect me. It's going to affect my kids. It's going to affect people I care about. And so here we are. But I think 2008 and to an extent 9/11 both got people used to this sort of thing. And they're falling in line. I've been enjoying some of your Twitter lately about these Karens out there reporting on businesses that are open. I mean, you know, Daniel McAdams, who's a good friend of mine, he spent a lot of time in Hungary, and he got to know older Hungarians who remembered life under the Soviets and the idea of snitching on your neighbors. And that's something that's now, I think, not coming to America, but actually here.
Well, when people who love the Mises Institute, like myself, think of the Mises Institute, the first thing we think of is economics, Austrian economics, the only economics. And can we talk a little bit about this money printing? I mean, I know a lot of it, you know, overnight loans, things like that, people don't really understand what that is. But seeing trillions pumped in to essentially, as David Stockman says, to keep the stock market up, mm-hmm. something that was that's supposed to be a gamble. The stock market is supposed to be Las Vegas. Every prospectus I've ever read says past performance is no indication of future of what's going to happen in the future. So they're basically creating money out of thin air again, pumping it in to prop this thing up that shouldn't be a guarantee. So what do you think all this money printing is going to do?
Well, it all goes back really in the modern era anyway to 1987 and Black Monday, which I was too young to be in markets at that time. I guess I was starting college in 87 about, but my older brother, who was already out and working, had – I remember him saying that he lost a lot of his savings or investments on that day. And that's when Alan Greenspan decided that he would institute what's been called since then the Greenspan put, which is that he wanted to assure markets that he would provide enough liquidity in any crisis to make sure that that never, ever happened again, because it happened on his watch. And that's the last thing any Fed chair wants. I mean, let's not forget that a lot of this is political and personal. And so he determined that that would never happen again. And in a sense, it has happened again. But in a sense, they have been able to overcome these things with just sheer amounts of new base money. And this applied to the Asian financial crisis of the 1990s, to the tech stock bubble of 1999-2000, of course, to the housing and Lehman Brothers collapse in 2008. And now they're trying to reflate everything once again. I'm not sure it's going to work this time. I think all the assets on banks' balance sheets are now so leveraged that I don't think that this is going to resuscitate the patient this time. That's an opinion. I don't know that. But I think the amount of debt in the global economy, and let's remember, all of that is much higher than it was in 2008. Sovereign debt, corporate debt, household debt, individual debt, car loans, mortgages, credit cards, student loans, the whole shebang, bigger, worse than 2008, which means that these kinds of things become more weaponized. They become more systemic across the whole globe, which is really scary. So I don't think that this is going to work. And what's interesting is that when they're throwing these numbers around, Larry Kudlow, oh my gosh, this guy, Mr. King Dollar, has been on TV the last couple of days, well-dressed, cocaine addict, love him. But nonetheless, he's been talking about the total stimulus between the fiscal side, the Treasury, and the monetary side, the Fed, would be something in the neighborhood of $6 trillion, and saying that this is the kind of number that's needed to combat this. And a few days ago, we were talking about $2 trillion in the bailout bill. And not too long ago, a decade or so, 12 years ago, $1 trillion seemed like a huge number. So these numbers get funnier and funnier. But what's interesting is that the fact that they say, let's say, $2 trillion in the bailout bill being considered today by Congress, you know, what? Well, if $2 trillion is good, why not four? If $2 trillion is good, why not 20? Why not add a zero to it? And the reason they don't is because they understand on some level, however deep in their lizard hindbrain that might be, And the American public understands on some level that you can't just create a bunch of money out of thin air without creating any new wealth and services, or excuse me, goods and services in the economy. On some level, we all sort of get that viscerally. And this, to me, is one of the ultimate, I don't want to say vindications, but it's one of the ultimate takeaways from Austrian economics, is that money's never neutral and that creating more money doesn't produce any new goods and services in the economy. What it does is it hurts people who are holding money, especially people who are stuck, you know, older people who are stuck later in life and not able to go out and make anymore. So, yeah, it's really something. And I guess it was to be expected. I mean, we certainly knew that the stock market was way overheated. And we certainly knew that the Fed would throw everything in the kitchen sink into bailing it out again. We didn't know as clearly what the fiscal side would do, what the Treasury would do. And I guess Trump probably – we all said this back in 2012. You know, nobody really should want to be the next president because this overheated stock market is going to come crashing down during their presidency and they're going to take the blame for it. And that's in fact what's happened to Trump. I mean, imagine if all this had just happened a year later. Who knows? Maybe he'd been reelected and he'd be president right now, or in his second term right now. But it's happening when it's happening. And we should be very clear that this virus thing is not the cause of this. This virus is not the proximate cause of any of this. It is at most the straw that broke the camel's back, at least from my perspective.
Well, I do want to talk about unemployment, because I've seen non-hysterical people saying that if this goes through May, we could be looking at 20% to 30% unemployment. If that happens, I mean, we're talking, I think the Great Depression, at its worst point in the Great Depression, it was 25%. So if you get to 25% or 30%, who do you think will be running up there arguing UBI? Because it just seems like this is the perfect storm for people to say, yeah, we need a universal basic income and we should have done this a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is they compiled unemployment statistics more honestly back in the 1930s than they do now. Today, a lot of people are excluded who have really just sort of given up. Unemployment's actually, even during the supposed Trump boom, is actually a lot higher than they say, because a lot of people have just become perpetual students into their 30s. A lot of people have just, a lot of, let's say, stay-at-home moms have just stopped looking. There's all kinds of ways in which unemployment's actually much higher than they say. A lot of people retired early after 08, that sort of thing. So I think UBI is going to be very popular. It's hilarious to me that the Democrats have come up with Joe Biden. I mean, just the appearance of competence. If you look at somebody like, what was his name? Mayor Pete. I mean, he strikes me as a real sick MF-er and a creation of the CIA or something. Where does this guy come from? South Bend, Indiana or something? Give me a break. But nonetheless, at least on stage, in his weaselly, oily way, he could sort of stand there and present the appearance of competence with his words, if nothing else. And so if there was ever a time when Americans have given up the ghost and are just crying out for some sort of bureaucratic or managerial or technical competence, you'd think this was it. Somebody you just say, hey, I could have handled this coronavirus better. I could have handled the bailout better. I could have directed the funds more competently, whatever it is. And it's Biden. It's Joe friggin' Biden. Oh, wow. Strange times. And I know you and I want to talk about some silver linings maybe later here in the program, but I think there are some. And maybe just the emperor has no clothes is the starting point of all that.
Sure. Yeah, we definitely need to talk about silver linings because I see them there. Another thing, talking about UBI, talking about just monetary policy, this digital dollar. Have you seen this, that they've worked this into the bill? And then I heard they've taken it out, but they're going to try and put it into the new bill to basically create a digital dollar. It looks like they want to get rid of physical cash, and they'll use any excuse to do it.
Yeah, I've heard different reports about that being inserted and taken out over the past 24 hours. Things are very much in flux. And anyone who's spent any time on Capitol Hill knows that these huge spending omnibus type bills are very unholy from a process perspective. There's lots and lots of people slithering around the various committees who are marking it up, and there are lots of lobbyists getting little things inserted, and who knows what's on page 481 of this bill, where it says in U.S. Code 28, Section 1336, strike little paragraph I, insert, or, dot, dot, dot. I mean, these things could have huge financial ramifications, and virtually no Americans other than maybe five committee staffers would even understand the impact of that sort of thing. Sometimes that's very common. So beware any bill that gets rushed through over a period of days that's lengthy, because there could be all kinds of stuff in there. Now, this, fortunately, the internet and social media glommed onto, just because I think there's a lot of interest in crypto. And so somehow this little idea got outed, and I hope it doesn't end up in there. But look, they hate cash. They always have. And this is oftentimes a cultural thing. If you look at Scandinavia, they're virtually a cashless society. Most people pay for everything with their phones. If you look at there's some strange deviations from this. Germany and Austria, for example, have a particular savings culture where cash is still preferred. I was in Austria recently, and there are a lot of places that are cash only. A lot of places out on the street, food stands, that sort of thing, which struck me. And of course, when you get into poor countries, and much of China, for example, is still very poor on a per capita basis, it's all cash. It would be very hard for them to implement electronic only money and track your spending, track your income, all that sort of thing. But here in the West, I'm sure they're going to say that physical cash spreads the virus. So that's a very nice way to go after it. And the other thing is, let's just imagine you're a Walmart. Every day, you got a zillion stores all over the country. Every day, you have to make sure every one of those cash register cash boxes has enough dimes and pennies and ones and 20s to deal with people's physical cash. I mean, as long as all your competitors had to do away with cash too, at the same time, I would imagine Walmart, from a lobbying perspective, would love a cashless society and would promote and support and endorse that, wouldn't they? I mean, that would be a huge cost of doing business alleviated for them. So, I think this will probably add fuel to the fire to the voices who are calling for a cashless society. And it's so funny, because I heard Nancy Pelosi was somewhat behind this. Nancy Pelosi probably knows about as much about any of this as my Labrador Retriever does. But, a lot like him, she's, she likes to be petted and told what to do. So very, very spooky stuff.
How about the fact that with all the governors, and that's one thing about this whole situation that I don't think a lot of people are picking up on, or maybe I hope people are, is the fact that a lot of these draconian type measures are not coming from the top down as far as federal, but they're coming from the state. And it just seems to me like Georgia has not issued a shutdown yet. I mean, I think they did something the other day where they said bars and nightclubs, unless you can keep people, 6 feet away from each other, you're going to have to shut down, which is horrible. And I want to come back to that. But I mean, it's not like, California, where people are on lock. I'm talking to people, I talk to people out there, and I mean, they're completely, I was talking to someone in Switzerland the other day. He's on lockdown for a month. I mean, from March 19th to April 19th. So, all over the place, even all over the world, people are getting shut down. But it seems like if this thing goes on through May, they're talking about this, May 1st will be the day that the ICU units will be overrun, and then it'll be chaos. If they keep businesses shut down, I mean, we may see, and it's very likely, the destruction of small business, small retail outlets, your bars, your restaurants, all the independents and everything. So, I mean, we've never seen anything like this before. I mean, it's even in wartime. I mean, this is so bizarre and so original, for lack of a better term, that I don't even know how to start talking about some of these subjects.
Yeah. And of course, it's fluid day to day. And let's think for a second. I mean, during the London bombings in World War II, people still went to work. Okay, sure. When there was active bombing happening, they all went down into the tube stops, but people still went to work. So this is nothing like the Great Depression, where your business was shut down and not allowed to operate. It's nothing like World War II in that sense. It's also nothing like the crash of 08, which was mostly a stock market phenomenon. And so businesses out there, they struggled. They laid people off. Let's not sugarcoat it, but they could be creative and come up with new ways. They could, you know, immediately go into couponing or two-for-one specials or this or that and find ways to compete. And, you know, those that were better focused and maybe had a little more cash in the bank were able to survive 08, and some of them weren't. I mean, that's not a happy thing. And what happened in 2008 wasn't just some market phenomenon. As Austrians, we can go into a lot of reasons why things were over-leveraged then too. But nonetheless, businesses were at least allowed to be out there trying things and getting creative. Whereas this is a very different animal, and it is going to get a lot of people used to and accustomed to the idea that they can just sit at home and get money from the government. I mean, that seems to me like a crazy, crazy scary thing, that the government is now effectively taking over and nationalizing, or at least ordering businesses around. And so I have taken a little bit of heart in seeing some of the governors on TV yesterday saying we're not doing what New York and California are doing. We'll see how long that lasts, if they get actually a few deaths going in their states, or if they get a little nervous about Fed money. I mean, we could see FedGov just threatening them all the way Reagan used to do with highway funds in the 80s. We've seen time and time again that governors tend to roll over pretty quick. And you don't get to be governor of a state these days without being a rollover type. I mean, let's just face it. So I'm not sure how long that's going to last. I was absolutely heartened by Trump saying yesterday, hey, the whole country is not the same. Maybe it's OK for people to be out and about in rural parts of Texas, but not OK for them to be out in Manhattan or so. Absolutely true. I mean, I want to hear more of that. And he kept talking about Easter. This morning I was driving in and he said, well, you know, Easter is very important to me. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm sure Easter is a meaningful religious day for Donald Trump all these years. He's been genuflecting at the altar of the church he attends, you know. But hey, you know, he's talking about people being full, you know, churches being full on Easter. Wouldn't that be great? And the commentariat are freaking out, saying, oh my gosh, that's 19 days away. He's crazy. And I don't know, maybe he is crazy, but man, oh man. I mean, the you know, getting back to the idea of trade-offs here, we cannot shut down the world over a virus. We have ways of dealing with viruses. If we let markets go after it, people are going to find all kinds of ways to kill or disinfect or immunize, or, you know, try different medications or whatever it might be, distance themselves, you know. And what's somewhat missing in all this, I have seen a lot of libertarian outlets sticking to their guns and saying, look, there's a lot of FDA problems. There's a lot of regulatory problems. There's reasons why, you know, there's so many beds at hospitals. And those are all true and good things to say. But you know, just the concept of private property needs to be, I think, stressed, whereby if you're a property owner, you could potentially in a tort system be liable for people coming onto your property for business purposes and getting sick, whether that's your employees or your customers or whatever. So that in and of itself creates a huge incentive to be scrubbing everything down and Windexing and sanitizing or whatever you might be doing. And the other thing is that this is a tough thing to say, but markets aren't perfect. Markets are just human beings coming together, hopefully unmolested by government, and doing what they do every day to try to make themselves materially better off. And so in an unregulated market system, would hospitals and medical providers just sit around with 30 or 40% unused excess capacity because there might be an every 50-year virus come along that would require them to have that capacity? No, I think the answer is they probably wouldn't. I mean, let's just be honest. Markets can't make everything just okay all the time. Sometimes life sucks and bad things happen. And a virus could be that sort of thing. I make no claims about the origins of this, how it came about, whether we knew about it, should have known about it, Chinese complicity. I don't know. Those are all factual matters. I don't know whether this thing was actually just Mother Nature or not. Okay. But, you know, I mean, it's maybe a virus would come along and kill a bunch of people who are fat and smoke and old, or, you know, and I know it's hurting some young people too. That's a terrible thing. But this idea that there's some system out there that could just prevent every sort of unpleasantness is just not realistic. And I think that's what a lot of people are looking for now, is the government is just going to protect us from everything. And that when these bad things happen, it's because of a lack of planning or foresight, and especially funding on the part of government. That's just not true. And so I don't think those of us who don't believe in government, not in the Santa Claus sense, but, you know, don't think it's good, I don't think we should be too far in our claims about what markets could have done. Sometimes bad things happen.
Speaking of, well, I talked about small businesses. Let's talk about big businesses such as the airlines and Boeing. I mean, immediately people started talking about bailing them out. But I've also heard, you know, maybe the Fed needs to start buying up stock of, you know, these industries. Doesn't that just sound like nationalization, like, see, you know, a Federal Reserve way of seizing the means of production? I mean, are they, I question whether a lot of these businesses are completely public. I think a lot of them have a very public-private relationship, which is scary. They are literally talking about, like, bailing them out by buying up their stock. Mm-hmm. What kind, has that ever been done before, as far as you know, in American financial history?
Well, it's been done on a de facto basis. You know, we've taken ownership stakes in companies during wartime, in effect, because we were directing their activities during World War II. For instance, both my grandfather and father worked for Firestone Tire and Rubber Company. And during World War II, that whole entire industry was basically forced into wartime production for tank treads and that sort of thing, rather than automobile tires. And automobile tires in the United States were rationed during World War II. You couldn't just buy them whenever you wanted. So that's an interesting thing to think about. But when it comes to the idea that taxpayers should get something for their bailouts and maybe they should get an ownership stake, you can see the allure of that kind of argument. Hey, if we're going to bail you out and subsidize your losses, maybe we should subsidize or collectivize the gains. And so we should own part of your business as taxpayers. Well, of course, you and I know that government's never actually, you know, taxpayers don't own or run government. Government's a thing unto itself, and it's going to be the beneficiary of this. And of course, we also know that when you have a nominally private company like Boeing and you're directing it from Washington, D.C., then that the term for that is fascism. Okay, that's literal fascism as opposed to the fascism we hear people accused of all day long on Twitter. And so what that means is, look, but you're right, Boeing's barely private because a big part of their business is defense and government contracting. And even a big part of their private airliner business is subsidized in effect by the Export-Import Bank, which is a very unholy organization that is backed by the hapless U.S. taxpayer that loans money. It provides a credit facility to foreign governments, let's say, some of which are pretty scummy in the Middle East. And they use this guaranteed loan to buy Boeing aircraft. So that's not purely a market transaction. And of course, Boeing was already in big trouble with this 737 MAX issue. They had built several hundred of these things that were ordered that could not be delivered because of the software glitch, and they're sitting. They're sitting rotting, and they need a new software before they could even be sold. So even before this travel shutdown, Boeing was having a difficult time with its 737 MAX problem. So this is this is just something where, you know, people used to say the senator from Boeing, because Boeing had so much power in the federal government and was so deeply connected through the Export-Import Bank. And the other thing about a company like Boeing is – they provide a lot of jobs, and a lot of those are well-paid technical engineering type jobs. So, you know, someone who thinks like Trump, for instance, and to be fair, a lot of Americans, just says, well, that kind of is, you know, Boeing is so critical to American business. We all got to fly around if things are ever going to get back to normal. that we really can't just have it up to market forces. We can't have Boeing going bankrupt, for example. So we need to bail it out. And maybe that bailout should take the form of public so-called ownership of a percentage of Boeing stock. I have heard that the Boeing CEO rejected this and said no. And I don't understand why they can't just go to these new credit facilities which are being created and basically borrow at about 0% interest against their many assets, which include not only the factories and the aircraft themselves, but all the contracts they own. So they've got assets to pledge against loans. They can go borrow money. They can go sell stock. Now, their stock's in the tank, but why don't they go sell stock like companies used to raise cash? And here's a crazy idea. Sell a friggin' airplane. That's a way to raise money. Hey, you know, guess how the deli down the street from me raises money? They sell deli sandwiches. Wow, novel concept. So I don't want a penny to Boeing. Any member of Congress who votes for this stimulus bill ought to be run out on the rails and absolutely thrown out of office in November. Every one of them. We ought to reelect not a single one. Will the Rand Pauls and Thomas Massies be forced to vote for this? I don't know. I think they'll probably vote no. And they'll probably be able to vote no from a political perspective because this bill will pass overwhelmingly. And I'm not sure what the political fallout to them will be of voting no. Massie does have a creepy Republican primary opponent who's a neocon type. I don't know offhand when the Kentucky primary is. So there could be a political fallout, a political price to pay. I'd love to see Massie and Rand vote no on this piece of crap. But wow, I mean, the Murray Rothbard, paraphrasing him, once said that the Democrats engineer the great leaps forward and the Republicans consolidate the gains. But these last couple crises have been with the Republican president. You know, you had the end of Bush during the 08 crash, and then Obama came in. You had Bush during 9/11, and now you got Trump. So the big entitlement great leaps forward are now happening under Republicans. So, we got to come out of this understanding that people are going to become inured to the seriousness of this, that they are going to become more and more accepting of government giving them money, of government bailing things out, of government nationalizing industries, of government making decisions about ostensibly private resources. And basically the idea of a command control economy is becoming more and more palatable to millions of Americans, and this virus ain't helping. So I think what we have to understand is that we may find ourselves in a period of post-persuasion where we need to figure out how to unyoke ourselves politically rather than convince the rest of America.
If you enjoy the show and you feel like you're benefiting from it, please support me on Patreon. It's patreon.com/Mance Rayder. I just added a $2 level, which allows you to get early episodes. Also on freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. I have the same levels as Patreon listed on there, but you can do it by the year, and you can do it for cryptocurrency, or you can do it for fiat. Thank you very much. Before we jump into positive things that come out of this, all we've been talking about basically so far is economics. I just wanted to talk about how dystopian some of the measures are. One, for example, and I posted this up on Twitter yesterday, I hope people saw it, is there are some states where you have to have papers from the government in order to be in your car and driving. When you look at this virus, and of course, they don't know everything about it yet, but it seems that it's really dangerous to older people, boomers and above, and people who have immune deficiency disorders. Yet, you know, somebody like yourself, who I assume is in perfect health, I mean, if they instituted something in Alabama where only what are they calling them? I can't remember the phrase.
Essential.
Essential. They're allowed to drive. I mean, you wouldn't be allowed to drive. I mean, it's just, how crazy is this? I mean, have we ever seen anything like this before? I mean, I can't find anything in our history.
No, and the damnable part of it all, of course, is that there's at least anecdotal evidence that heat and humidity might alleviate the virus, that it might have some seasonal qualities like ordinary flu. And so what Californians ought to be doing, what Floridians ought to be doing, is being outside in the sunshine, because vitamin D might help as well. I don't know that for a fact, but I suspect it. And so forcing everyone to be cooped up inside their houses, especially if one of them has the virus on their body, is going to just increase the spread of it far more than probably people out going to work. So it's pretty scary. I mean, wartime powers, we used to understand, or I should say our grandparents used to understand, or at least expect that wars had an end. But the war on terror doesn't have any end. That began back in 2001, and we haven't had any scale back of any of the authoritarian programs that were implemented for that, like the Department of Homeland Security is still with us, the TSA is still at the airport, that sort of thing. And TSA is basically a papers please organization. You can't fly without this stuff. And so this is in a sense just a ratcheting up of that. You can't fly without showing papers, and well, now maybe you can't drive without showing papers. So and who's essential? Well, of course the Congress is always essential. Cops are always essential. You know, I mean they always make themselves essential. And I did note that I think what's his name, de Blasio, has been going to the gym in New York. He gets driven in some black SUV to his gym, which I guess they wipe down and he uses all alone or something. So some people are more essential than others. And I don't consider de Blasio, he's not some sort of fitness expert from what I can tell. But, travel – moving around it's really something to behold. And I hope that my governor here in Alabama doesn't do this, because we're still out and about somewhat. There's a fair amount of carry out food. The gas stations are open. Putting people into small houses and apartments for months at a time, I mean, what is that going to do to people's health? And they're going to stare at screens all day. They're going to eat carbohydrates. They're probably going to drink more alcohol. They're probably going to hit their kids out of frustration. They're probably going to do all kinds of things and get fatter and weaker and softer. And wow, so much of economics, but so much of politics too, is the seen and the unseen. So we can, this is very hard to put a price on this over time. And what is the economic slowdown or economic collapse? Let's pray it doesn't come to that. What does that mean for people's long-term health consequences? How much worse will heart disease and diabetes and cancer and stroke become as a result of this? So we're going to have chimpanzees pointing to how many lives we saved by shutting everything down, but they won't be able to tell us how many lives we've cost by shutting everything down, because that's really hard to do. That's really hard to trace, even with all of our bazillion PhD social scientists out there. They're really bad at that. Very, very tough. And I'd like to see a little old-fashioned Irish democracy at work here, especially in these smaller towns. I mean, you get into some of these megalopolises like L.A., and the cops are basically roided out, tatted up. What's that movie with the RoboCop? they're RoboCops, and they're not reasoning humans. But in a town like Auburn, Alabama, where I happen to live, 100,000 people, a lot of people actually know. I think there's 15 cops or something like that. A lot of people know them. They actually have to face the public a little more. I mean, if you're in a smaller town and you're bossing people around and ordering them, maybe that feels a little different. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to be the panacea, but I've heard from some of my friends and family in California that they've now finally gotten people off the beach, and they've done this by driving pickup trucks on the sand and using bullhorns and being very belligerent. And so if you have a couple thousand people out walking on the beach, even staying 5 feet apart from each other, whatever, that's a pretty tough thing to do anything about. But if you get it down to a few hundred and then you grab a few of them and cart them off to jail or something like that, make an example, you can use the bullying tactics and scare people into compliance. And it sounds like that is happening on a lot of California and Florida beaches, which would be a place where you'd expect lots of people to be out walking, especially now in the spring. So, you know, do we have it in us as Americans to show a little backbone and engage in a little Irish democracy and go out there anyway? It works if people do it in mass, if they're just dismissive of the orders. It doesn't work if just a few do it, because then you could pick them off if you're a cop. So I hope to read more about this happening. And we are finding we're hearing good things about business owners who are being very sly or entrepreneurial. Read yesterday about a strip club that was using its strippers to send to deliver takeout food. And, you know, you're supposed to get, you know, tip the girl a little bit when she delivers it, obviously. But the flip side is that we're hearing through people like you about the Karens of the world out there, you know, narking on people who, oh my gosh, there's a bunch of construction guys still working on this roof in my neighborhood or something. So, wow, Americans, let's it'd be fascinating to see what happens. That's all I can say.
Yeah, if you read all of the old stories of the old West and how just individualistic they were and everything, now you just realize how that's all gone. I mean, it's just people just my government told me to do it. I'm not going to question that. All right, let's go on to try to find some positives in this. And one thing that I've heard people say is China manufactures our pharmaceuticals, and you know, we have to get them from them. But you know, how do we? All of this started in China. What a better time to make arguments like, okay, yeah, let's make that here, sure. But we're going to have to do some union busting because they're what makes everything expensive. And we're going to have to do some deregulation because that's what makes everything. This cure that they're calling it, I know that South Korea, this anti-malarial drug, I know South Korea started using it in February and they've basically, quote unquote, flattened the curve. They've been using it in other places. I heard about a doctor in a Hasidic community where there were 600 cases, and he's been treating people with this drug, and everybody's recovering in New York City. I mean, and I'm not only talking about pharmaceuticals; I'm talking about anything. If you want to bring this manufacturing home, what better time to start arguing against union wages, which is one of the reasons manufacturing is driven overseas, and regulation, which a lot of people now who you wouldn't expect it are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, can we loosen up these regulations so that we can get things moving a little bit quicker? And this seems like a golden opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And let's not forget that China is not the only place to which we outsource manufacturing. I mean, one of the great benefits of a global economy is that, you know, for a while, China was the cheap place to go move your factory, but then it started to get competition from places like Sri Lanka and Vietnam. And so everything in Walmart that used to just say made in China, a lot of it now says made in Honduras or made in Vietnam or someplace like that. So this is, you know, the idea that we shouldn't be reliant on a single trading partner for something. Okay, that's probably true. But, you know, what we think of as global free trade is actually quite a mishmash. And again, the seen and the unseen, this is very hard for social scientists to make transparent and understandable for average people. A lot of what we call the global economy and global trade is a result of very unholy trade agreements that are overseen by quasi-governmental groups like WTO. A lot of it results from just the sheer financialization of the economy. And what central banks have done, making money so cheap and credit so cheap. So we can't just assume that, let's say, aspirin is made in China very, very inexpensively solely because of, you know, that's just how free trade works out and we have too many regulations here in the U.S. I mean, it's a little more complex than that. And there may be reasons why it's actually cheaper to get a Kia shipped here all the way from Korea on a boat. Think how much that costs alone than it is to buy a Ford. Now, of course, a lot of Kias are made in the U.S. Don't get me wrong, but you know, there's reasons for that, and I think unions are a lot of it, and I think the regulatory state is a lot of it. but it's complex. And complexity is not in vogue at the moment. You know, the American public's looking for black and white answers. And for the bourgeoisie, a black and white answer is, oh, well, all the aspirin's made in China. We ought to bomb China. They gave us this bat virus. When in fact, the average Chinese person is just, they're trying to raise their kids or pay for their rent or get some food. You know, the idea that if anything, Chinese people are less culpable for the state of their government than Americans are. I will say that's a real difference between China and America and I guess what we're going to call the CCP. They don't even have this illusion of, the government's us. So let's just back off on the China hatred a little bit. And, the silver lining here is that, hey, there's lots of things we could probably do in America if we weren't so stupid about everything, especially the regulatory and tax burdens. And, shipping's a big part of the cost of goods. And if things were made closer, that's one cost that's alleviated a bit. But at the end of the day, what's so fascinating here is it doesn't matter who you are. At the end of the day, certain things you rely on are absolutely localized. They have to get to you, to your house, to your CVS, to your public supermarket, whatever it is. And it doesn't matter how rich you are, how poor you are. That's the reality. That includes healthcare. Wherever you happen to find yourself, that's where you're going to have to go to the doctor or hospital if need be. And let's say you're uber rich. Let's say you're Bill Gates and you can build a surgical suite in your house and you can employ 3 or 4 full-time doctors to live in your house and just be ready to provide you medical care or something. I mean, some bizarre, rich person fantasy of a bunker in New Zealand or something. Okay, but even then, I mean, the electricity coming into your house is localized. The ability to go out and get drugs or provide food and water and all that is very, very localized. And there's a documentary. I got to plug this because I saw it the other night. There's a documentary about the incredible life of Thomas Massie. We mentioned him earlier as a congressman from Kentucky. It's called Off the Grid, and it's free on Amazon Prime. That's how I watched it. And it's pretty short. It's like 35 minutes. And his house really is off the grid. He provides electricity via solar and that sort of thing. He has some elevations differences. Now, this is a big farm in Kentucky. And those elevation differences, there's a pond at higher elevation, which is replenished very frequently by rainwater. And he has a system of pipes and tubing that just use that natural height differential to provide water pressure. And then he obviously does some things to purify or clean the water. So that was fascinating to me. But something he says during this, he says, boy, electricity is the vulnerable spot for most Americans because you try to go a couple of days without electricity and you'll find out what kind of misery that really is. And so none of us, even Bill Gates, none of us are really independent of government and localism unless we're out there doing a Thomas Massie. And most of us are not going to do that. Let's be honest. So, the interconnectedness of all of this and the local element of it. I mean, at the end of the day, there's a plane or a boat or a train and almost always an 18-wheel truck, which requires gas and a driver, by the way, to get those 50 kinds of toothpaste to your target that Bernie Sanders hates so much. So it doesn't take much to make that break down. And I hope that this gives us all an appreciation of what we could be doing locally in making things freer, as opposed to always looking to Washington. Because look, the experts have failed us. I mean, it's almost comical to watch these CDC and NIH clowns on TV every day. That ain't gonna help you. Wash your hands. Oh, thanks. So at the end of the day, maybe we all need a little less hubris. Libertarians don't have any grand answers either. And we need to look at things and say, hey, when things get ugly, where does my aspirin really come from? Where does my food really come from? Where does my water and electricity? And so you might find at the local level, people are a lot more interested in hearing what you have to say about liberty than they are at this molasses slow moving Borg we have in Washington, which just seems so entrenched. So if we're talking about silver linings, people turning away from the experts, turning away from Washington, D.C., what we might call the media academic government complex, which is all interrelated, you know, the CNNs of the world, the PhDs at all these rotten schools, proving themselves useless during this crisis, by the way, and government itself funding a lot of it and creating perverse incentives for a lot of it. And saying, hey, these people don't really know any better than us. The health officials don't. People at the Fed are groping around blindly. Oh, my God, what do we need to do to create, you know, let's create loan facilities for mutual funds and let's buy up municipal bonds as collateral if we have to stop those from sinking. I mean, it's clear to anybody with who's sentient, who's observing all this, they don't know what the hell they're doing. They're scrambling around like chickens with their heads cut off. And so self-sufficiency and a more localist mentality, that's something that I really like. And so I hope that that, I guess, grows a little bit or becomes – that gets onto people's radar screens as a result of this hellscape we're in at the moment.
Well, I think another thing you can see is – and I know a few people after the 2008 crisis that basically dropped out. They lost their jobs. They dropped out. They started their own business. And they, you know, just became self-sufficient that way. So I really think there's an opportunity here for people to do that as well. But the next thing I wanted to go on to was a positive thing that can come out of this is I think we're starting to see that even normies are looking at the dollar and going, okay, what? I mean, I have people contacting me going, how do I buy silver? How do I buy gold? And I'm like, if you've been on any of the places that you can normally buy it from, they're just out.
Yeah.
I mean, they're out. So this is stuff you should have been doing like my, you know, I've been doing it for years and you should have been doing this, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, put it in safe deposit box, put it in your safe at home, whatever. But if the if people start losing faith in the dollar, we can really start talking about gold and silver-backed secure money again. And I think that this is a perfect opportunity to do it because there's no way they could just print $1 trillion overnight to bail someone out. And we wouldn't even be getting into these situations. I mean, every once in a while, but, you know, it'd be a lot easier to come out of.
Well, I would say I'm biased, but I would say that the provision of money in a society is one of the biggest political issues of all. And it just doesn't even get talked about. And the two sides, so-called, are in complete agreement of this. I saw Steve Bannon on CNN the other day talking about, oh my gosh, we got to do X, Y, and Z. We got to go big. We got to spend trillions. We can worry about the balance sheet later. I mean, you know, there's no party here. The party is them versus us. And us is people who are stuck with dollars for our savings or whatever we've got. And that's most Americans, unless you're really rich and you can diversify yourself across currencies and also across political risk. You know, really rich people have bank accounts in other countries. They have homes in other countries, et cetera. You and I presumably don't have that. Or I don't. I'll just speak for me. For all I know, Peter's got – I don't know what you've got, Peter. You're a strange cat. But, you know, this idea that these guys are going to – cure all this. And I think normies, as you mentioned, are going to be sitting there going, wait a minute. If this is so good for us, why don't they just do it all the time? Why does it take some sort of emergency to make this happen? And if government can just do this at will and send me $2,000 and there's not going to be any long-term harm as a result, and inflation's under control, as they tell us constantly, which is total well, gee whiz, why don't they just keep sending me $2,000 forever? Well, why don't they just send me $4,000? I mean, these are the kind of what ifs that are coming to the fore right now. It's pretty fascinating. And again, I wish I could observe all this impartially, like be a Martian or something and sit there and watch this. But we can't be impartial. And, you know, when you say maybe people will be more open to these ideas, I certainly hope so. Are we too late? Are we, you know, is it like – like driving a car around a bend with a cliff, a steep cliff beyond, there's some point at which you're too close to the cliff and you're moving too fast that there's no amount of braking or countersteering at that point that can stop you. You're going over the cliff. And I hope that's not the case. I don't know. Nobody can know. But But, you know, and does it take going off the cliff to create, you know, basically a new society based on a new form of currency? I don't know. But there's got to be a lot of newfound interest in cryptos. The idea that we could have a store of value and a payment system totally outside of the government's clutches, with the huge caveat that I mentioned earlier, which is electricity. Bitcoin requires electricity. Your cell phone requires electricity. It also requires a network. Your wallet requires you to access it. So we're never totally out of their clutches. But it's got to be raising huge interest. I mean, gold and silver, we did an anecdotal survey all around within 100 miles of Atlanta this morning, which were, you and I are somewhat close. I live within 100 miles of Atlanta. And so Wesley, who works here, and I did a phone survey this morning of various pawn shops and gold dealers, metals dealers all around that 100-mile radius. None of them have hardly any physical silver, even 1 ounce coins. The Sprott price this morning ostensibly is like $16.39. And usually there's maybe a 5%, 4 to 5% premium over that. But nobody's letting any gold coins go for less than, you know, $1,800. And interestingly, though, if you talk to these people, it's so fascinating to talk to people who are on the front lines day to day of this current crisis we find ourselves in. And pawn shop guys really have their ear to the ground. They're a fascinating subculture. And as Lou Rockwell's pointed out, you know, pawn shops loan money without increasing the money supply. Which is a very fascinating and valuable service which pawn shops provide. And so everyone's so down on them. Oh my gosh, they charge these people 20%. Oh, well, okay. But, you know, guess what they've got? They've got some money to loan you, and they've got some firearms and some bullets and some gold and some other things you might want. And so the pawn shop guys actually follow this stuff in Congress because they have to. If a pawn shop guy lets you walk out the door today with a 1 ounce gold coin for $1,800 cash and carry. Now, that's the true spot price, again, minus that 4 or 5% premium for, you know, would gold dealers have to charge money to stay in business above and beyond what they pay. If he or she lets you walk out the door for $1,800, that's all well and good. He or she made money because they didn't spend that much for the coin. But nonetheless, if a week from now they could have gotten $2,000 for it, they made a mistake. They did something stupid. They cost themselves $200. So they really have to be ear to the ground. And anecdotally, pawn shops and gold dealers are actually expecting a possible dip in physical gold and silver prices, spot prices anyway, over the next week or two because this stimulus, this bailout is going to pass and the stock markets might recover a little bit as a result, and people might temporarily lose their shaken feeling because they know they're getting $2,000 pretty soon or something, and that might actually suppress gold and silver prices slightly. But in the longer run, you know, a month or two out, they're pretty bullish on gold prices. And so they, just like the rest of us, have to sit here and think, do I want to let this gold coin go for $1,800 today or do I not? And yeah, it's for sale, but maybe it's for sale at $2,000. So what's your spot price? Whatever you're reading online as to the spot price, I would argue that the actual price of gold, physical gold today, that you could take physical possession of today, there's a lot of sites where you can go pay a price, lock it in, and you're going to get it in 3 to 4 weeks. They say, I hope that's true, not casting any aspersions. But nonetheless, to me, the price, the spot price, spot is supposed to mean instant as opposed to future. The spot price for me today in Auburn, Alabama, to cash and carry a 1 ounce gold coin is something very different than the spot price being advertised online. So, a fascinating look at markets. And again, driving home the idea of localism. It doesn't matter what the ostensible price of gold is. It doesn't matter. None of this matters if you can't get it, if you don't have it locally, if you can't avail yourself of your GLD account or your Sprott account or whatever. You know, it's all just a hypothetical. But that guy in Auburn at a pawn shop today, that's about as real and local as it gets. And that to me is very fascinating.
I just wanted to mention that the Mises Institute has a book that I've referenced on more than one occasion called The Gold Standard Perspectives in the Austrian School that Lou Rockwell put together. It's got Murray Rothbard in there and a bunch of other people in it. It's just fascinating. It's a fascinating read. It's one of my, I consider it one of my most valuable books, just from a historical perspective and, you know, really understanding what money should be. So I guess the last thing I wanted to ask was, do you see this at all? I know we've already talked about people who are just looking to the government to save them. But what about the people who are looking and realizing that the government can't save them, that the government's not there to protect them? Do you think this is an opportunity to really reach out to those people and do as much as we can to point out that not only could they do nothing to stop this virus from spreading, but also their answer to it is destroying their everyday lives?
Yes, I think it's a huge opportunity. And it's also an opportunity to be loving and compassionate and say, you know, we're all different, but we're all human. And I love my little town here. I love the people in it. I don't want them harmed. I don't care what their politics are. I don't want anyone harmed. I don't want anyone made worse off. I have a particular barbecue spot, which I happen to love, and they're struggling to do takeout, but they're down 80-90%. And so that, you know, the particular guy who runs this barbecue spot, it's not a chain. I mean, I've talked to him a couple of times, and, you know, getting $2,000 from the government, I mean, his monthly rent's probably more than that. You know, this is an awfully specious promise coming out of Washington, D.C. And, you know, 2 weeks from now, a month from now, are we going to have to pass another bill? Or you shouldn't say we. Are they going to have to pass another bill? I mean, that's a hell of a way to run a country. And it all comes down to money and the value of it at the end of the day. And when you mess with that, you mess with everything in society. The ramifications as that cascades through society. I mean, messing with money, causing inflation is not just an economics issue. I mean, it causes all kinds. It erodes intergenerational relationships big time. It creates alcoholism. It creates, just vast problems that spread across the whole society. What, you know, you wouldn't even just consider it economic problems. And so, yeah, it is a great opportunity. And I think people are going to start to understand the wonderful thing about talking about money and value and a store of value and getting government away from money is it doesn't have really an ideological component. I mean, it's something where you can talk to someone of any political stripe and say, look, you know, this money they're spending up there in Washington that they don't have, it's not neutral. It's going to go to Wall Street and Boeing and Delta Airlines in ways that it's not going to come to you. Let's just, you know, come on. So it crosses ideological lines. It gets us past this Democrat-Republican thing. It provides an opportunity to say, vote for anybody else in the fall if you're a voter. Vote for anybody else, any third party, any new person, any independent, you know, the guy who, you know, the rent is too damn high guy. I don't care who. But just don't vote for a single one of them. I mean, a reset in Washington. Wow. You know, that's got to have some purchase right now in people's minds. So, yes, huge opportunity. No question.
Couldn't think of a better place to end it on. What do you want to plug?
Well, we're going to try to tell a story over the coming weeks and months, a story of what's happening and how we got here, and not let them get away with saying that the coronavirus is the cause of the economic crisis. It's not. It is a small cause of the current problem. You know, obviously the shutdown is a huge, huge problem, but the shutdown is not the virus. The shutdown is a reaction to the virus, and one that I personally think is crazy, crazy and wildly beyond. I mean, you know, wildly beyond what this virus justifies, but you know, opinions are going to vary, and maybe a million Americans really will die of this thing. I don't know about that because it's very hard to say. Everyone dies with viruses all over their body, and whether that was the actual direct cause of it or not is not so easy to ascertain. But we're going to try to tell a story that says, you know, here's how things were overleveraged. Here's what central banks have done since 08 to make it worse. And you know, here's why this breakdown is happening. Here's what Austrians have to say about this. And, you know, this isn't a time to sort of to try to be triumphant and say, oh, we were right about everything. Okay, well, you know, that's not – that nobody wants to hear that. They just want to understand. They want to hear an explanation. And it's very, very tough to get out there because there's so much white noise. There's the fog of war in every crisis. Even with all the digital information at our fingertips today, there's still the fog of war. We hear all kinds of things at the outset of a crisis which turn out later to not be true. And so any help that any of your listeners can provide in getting the real story out there and helping explain what's going on, whether that's from the Mises Institute or otherwise, is so important right now. We can't let them get away with the narrative. That's the single most important thing that some of us can do. Now, there's all kinds of other things people can go out there and help by doing. But you know, shaping the narrative and not letting them posit the coronavirus as the you know, the cause of all this. Oh, the global economy was absolutely fantastic and super stable, but then a virus came along and blew everything up. No, that's not the case. That's not true. And if we let them get away with that, then you know, capital is going to be blamed once again. Markets are going to be blamed once again for this. And we have to do everything in our power to not let them do that.
Well, it's always great talking to you. The work that you guys do and that you continue to do, and just how much that you guys make available, even for free, is remarkable. And it is a real service to the world. And I don't say that lightly, because I've heard you talk about how important understanding economics is, especially as a libertarian. You guys just make it so easy to get educated.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff. Take care.
Okay.
I want to thank you for tuning into the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Jeff for coming on. That's it. Be back in a few days with another episode. Take care and bye.